Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Joshu, the Zen master, asked a new monk, he was new in the monastery, "Have I seen you before?" And the new monk answered him, saying, "No, sir." And so Joshu said, "Have a cup of tea." And then Joshu turned to another monk and he said, "Have I seen you before?" And the second monk answered him and saying, "Yes, sir, of course you have." And then Joshu said, "Well, have a cup of tea." So later, the managing monk of the monastery, asked him, "How is it that you make the same offer of tea to any reply?" And at this, Joshu shouted, "Manager! Are you still here?" And the manager replied, "Of course, of course." And so Joshu said, "Have a cup of tea." Very simple little story, huh? You know, sometimes the more simple something is, the more difficult it appears to us. For one very simple reason, that a very simple something is usually something that cannot be divided when it is so simple. And we, as human minds, if we can't divide something, we don't seem to know how to analyze it. And if we can't analyze it, somehow or another, we don't know whereabouts we're at. The most simple thing in the world. The most simple thing in the world. You know what it is? The most simple thing in the world. Well, the most simple thing in the world is what you call God, or whatever name you want to use. Buddha nature, The most simple, the very, very most simplest thing in the world. So it's difficult to understand what God is, or what Buddha nature is. I don't think anybody understands what it is. In its singleness, you know, in its oneness, this is the height of simplicity. Its singleness. Difficult. You know, it's like Bodhidharma when he was talking to the Emperor Wu, and they went all through these questions of, you know, the Emperor saying, you know, he had built so many temples and he had published so many writings about Buddhism and so on. And so what was his merit? Nothing holy. And, you know, the questioning goes on until finally this emperor says to Bodhidharma, "Who are you? And Bodhidharma says, I don't know. Now that's Bodhidharma Zen, and that's Bodhidharma's understanding. He can say, I don't know. Bodhidharma's understanding is, I don't know. And that's very different than saying, oh, have you met so-and-so? No, I don't know that person. I don't know. Do you know how what two and two is? No, I don't know. That's very different than Bodhidharma's I don't know. Bodhidharma's I don't know is his understanding of what it's all about. Now, our world is very complex. And this human mind has such a good time trying to figure it out. Oh, it's so entertained by it, is trying to figure this thing out. And we have discovered that there are atoms and molecules and quasars and quarks and what have you, you know. And then there is the atomic table. And we have discovered that the Earth goes around the sun in this solar system, and that there are more solar systems. And a man has been to the moon, and he's planning to go to Mars or to Venus or some such. And then someday we're going to have all these stations in space where people can live, sort of like on an island, just as if they lived in Hawaii or Catalina or something like that. Huh? Yeah. We have had a marvelous time discovering. I mean, you know, we listen to somebody like James Burke on the television, and, you know, with his little program, The Day the Universe Changed. And this little thing that comes along, and it changes the viewpoint entirely. And it's tremendously interesting. It's very entertaining. Yeah. We discover things, and then we begin to argue about them, you know. Oh, but these fine points all about this thing. Oh, and then was so-and-so correct? No, so-and-so was correct. And we define what this is, and we define what that is. And then there are some things we can't define. You know, if I said to you, close your eyes and picture, what could we have, a blue shirt. How now will you tell me about that quality blue? Or if it were a black horse, what can you tell me about the blackness? What can you show me about the blackness? Do you know of any horse that doesn't have any color? Interesting. See, we live with these qualities. If something doesn't have any qualities, we give it qualities. And we do this a lot. So-and-so was talking to me, and I think they were very upset, you see. That's me. That's not the person talking to me. This is, I think. Yeah. Anyway, and here you are, here all of us, with this thing. As far as we are concerned, everything has qualities. It's colored. It has feeling. These are all qualities, huh? And now somebody says to us, you're going to find that which has no qualities. We don't even begin to know how to look. Because of consciousness, you know quality. But what kind of quality do you think consciousness has? The God that people, by and large, invoke, pray to, or whatever, you know, is a God of qualities. It's your personal God. It's what you have made of this word, God, in your world. He's good and he's kind and he's looking out after me and all that sort of thing. Now I say to you, you find that which we call God without any qualities. You can attribute nothing. You can endow him with nothing. Now what do you do? Somebody with these qualities, somebody wrote a book at one time in which he finally came to the conclusion that good is not definable. It's indefinable. Good cannot be defined. It is a simple quality. However, if something bad is around, then we can say what good is. If the opposite is present, if you and I are in the same room, and we're locked in this little room in here, huh? And you ask me, who are you? Well, at least I can say I'm not you. See, I have an opposite. I'm not you. See? But if I am alone, all alone, in a room, and I ask myself the question, who am I? Then what? So when you're sitting, you know, in meditation, who are you? You're all alone in that room. You should be. In your world. You should be all alone. Never mind dragging in other people and what they think and so on, huh? If there is nothing but I, what do I do with it? There's nothing opposite there to bounce it on. There's no wall or anything. And in a way, it stops us because now, not having something to bounce against, it's almost as if we can't think. Because we do think in opposites. And we're looking for this that we call either Buddha nature or God, you know, and both, either. God is all alone in his room, which is the universe. Buddha nature is all alone. How are you going to find it? People will go on and on with this thing, you know, trying to define what God is. And so they have come up with this, well, God is not the world. Something other. God is not matter. Something other. God is not body. You know, this is a good old Aristotelian logic. God is not desire. And God isn't this and God isn't that. Well, then what is God? Well, God is spirit. Okay, and so in our minds now we've got matter and spirit. And we're still in the soup, bubbling around, huh? You know, and then we try to make some boundaries. This is for matter and this is for spirit. See, and we fence our yards. And then we know the neighbor's yard almost as well as we know our own. Well, what if there is no neighbor? What if there's no one except you? How then are you going to make a boundary? God is alone. He's one. He's single. He has no neighbor. Then where does he begin and where does he end? People have been thinking about this for hundreds of years, thousands of years, huh? And so we have conceived of the devil. God is not the devil. We may not be able to say what God is, but we can say what he is not. We have said that he's not the world, And so then he's spirit, so he is everything except evil. And so to some, this world has become evil. And we must get out of it as best we can. We must not contaminate ourselves. And so we create some more boundaries. Wowie, what we do with it, huh? God is everything except evil. But then God is everything. From whence cometh this that we call evil? Is there some other source of existence? Are there two gods? Oh. Or did God really create the devil? And if so, how come we can call him good if he can create evil? How can good create evil? No. And if God destroys the devil, all this evil, then the opposite is no longer there. And so what happens to God? He disappears again in our thinking. Devil disappeared, so God disappeared. Do you ever watch how you think? Do you ever watch it, how, what steps you take to arrive at a conclusion, any conclusion? Always keep in mind, too, that whatever conclusion you come to, it is on that which you act. If you borrow somebody else's conclusion and you act on it, that's your fault. Yeah. These conclusions upon which we act and in which we seem to have such faith. Well, she told me to do so-and-so, but I don't think that's right. I'm going to do it my way. Go ahead, do it your way. The steps that we take to reach these conclusions on which we act, in which we have such faith, and in which we seem to have such security. Seem to have, huh? You know, we can observe what we believe and how come we believe it. We can observe how we reach the conclusions just by watching what we think, Right or wrong, doesn't make any difference. Just watch it, Watch what's going on in you. I mean, that's where it's all at, even God. Now, Joshua's story. And now this Zen master, he sees a monk. And he asked him, have I seen you before? No, sir, I'm here for the first time. Okay, have a cup of tea. Then he asked another monk, have I seen you before? Yes, sir, you have seen me before. I've been here a long while. I'm not a stranger. Okay, have a cup of tea. And the manager of the monastery, the Fusan, he's very puzzled by this. Two different persons responding in two different ways. And the master responds in exactly the same way to the stranger as to the friend, one who is here for the first time and one who has been here for a long time. He responds exactly the same to the known and to the unknown. Joshu responds same way. He makes no distinction. He doesn't say, you're a stranger, welcome, have a cup of tea. He didn't say to the longtime resident, you've always been around, you've been around here for a long time. No need to have any tea, huh? He didn't say, you've been around a long time, there's no need for me to respond. He responds just the same. What about this manager now, this Fusan? Joshu shouts at him, are you here? Then have a cup of tea. more to it than first meets the eye, as it were. You know, our human life, you know, we look at it, and it's a bundle of paradoxes and contradictions. And try as we will, sometimes it just doesn't make any sense at all. It just doesn't. We can't get those jigs together any which way to make a picture. A child may ask, why does the wind blow? You know, do you know why the wind blows? Well, it bloweth as it listeth, huh? And ye know not from whence it cometh, nor where it is going. I don't know. We have become, or maybe we have never ever been anything else, but we have become, seems to me, very muddled with our self-proposed problems. You know, we want to make something out of things that it isn't. We just can't relax with it and say, oh, this is the situation as it is. Last week, I was at a wedding, and the bride and the groom wanted the candle lit sometime during the ceremony, so I put it at the end, and all day a wind had been blowing, and it was in outdoors, in an atrium type of thing. So it came the time, and they tried to light the candle, and the candle wouldn't stay lit. The wind blew it out. And one of the groomsmen, we kept standing like that, trying to keep it protected, because it does represent, it is a symbol of eternal light. So they wanted this in their marriage, this symbology. So it blew out. They lit it again, and it blew out. And they lit it again, and it blew out. And finally, somebody turned to me and said, what does that mean? I mean, if they're going to have eternal light in their life, and now, God, no, you know. What would you answer them? I mean, you know, we do this all the time. We've got lessons to learn, and this to do, and that to do, and the other thing to do. Oh yeah, we got to be about our karma, and we got to be about our dharma. We don't know what it's all about anyway, but we got to be about it. You know? So what did that mean, that they didn't have this symbol? It's very simple. The wind was blowing, of course. No big deal about it. I mean, it wasn't that they're going to doom to darkness from here on out, or marriage is going to fail or something. No, the wind was blowing, you know. Eventually we learn, but boy, it sure takes a long time, it seems to me, my God. In this discipline, you know, which is called Zen, one begins eventually to think of discrimination and non-discrimination. And then somebody will look at it and say, but if you take non-discrimination or non-distinction all by itself, it doesn't make any sense. It's not logical. We know things as they are. And things are what they are simply by being distinguished and discriminated. And that's true. So non-distinction and non-discrimination must mean non-existence. Well, then what does non-existence mean? What is your idea of non-existence? What do you do with this word? Not the foggiest about non-existence, except what you conjure up in your imagination. Maybe conclusions you have reached without any observations. What is this non-existence, non-discrimination, non-ego, non-judgment? What are they? It seems to me, at times, I'm qualifying all over the place, that life as we ordinarily live it, ordinarily experience it, all within our qualities, it is a self-identification within contradictions. Yeah? We identify with this, and then we identify with that, which is exactly the opposite, and we don't know whereabouts we're at. You know, we identify with high, and we identify with low, and we identify with near, and we identify with far. And we don't seem to be able to unify these. We don't seem to be able to synthesize high and low. No. Red is red. And if it is red, it is not not red. No? Not red is not red. Hand is hand. And it is not a not hand. It is a hand. We call it a hand. In every language, we have a word for this. Hand in German and... Yeah, anyway. When we say something, this is a hand, that's an affirmation. And when we say it is not, this is a negation. In our world of discrimination and our making distinctions, negation and affirmation cannot be brought together all at once. The mind can't do this. Now, Zen says, in a way, bring it all together. How do you bring it all together? You drop it. You drop the negation and you drop the affirmation. And you are just exactly existing. Exactly, precisely existing. And in that precisely existing, the Zen master may ask, why is this called a hand? And if there's no answer speedily forthcoming, then he will say, oh, think about it. Yeah. For Joshu now, in his state of non-discrimination, everything is new. Everything is very mysterious. He's in awe of everything. Yeah. Be it the known or be it what was unknown. Huh? Makes no difference in non-discrimination. Now, you know, we come out here to this place several times a week. We come on Sundays to get our brains rattled a little bit now and then. And we come during the week so we can sit for meditation. And the place by now is familiar. And maybe you've stopped looking at the trees. Trees? We've seen them. You stop looking at the windows. Are they clean? Are they dirty? They're there. That's all. You've already seen them. They're just there. But for Joshu, everything, every moment is new. This kind of an awareness, this kind of an alertness. Huh? In this awareness only, everything is new. There's nothing old. Everything is of this moment, and it's always very fresh and very alive. There's no burden of the past. There's no burden of the future. The whole existence is just newly born, like a baby. Huh? and yet it is the wisdom of the Ancient of Days. It is fresh and clean. Yeah. You know, like a leaf that buds in the springtime, all fresh and clean before the dust settles on it. We sit for meditation, huh? So that the mind can be wiped clean. It's like you polish a window, wipe it clean, so it's as fresh as the world. And then they fit. And you don't worry about the world. You know, the world isn't the problem at all. And questions and answers are not the problem. They're pretty good sometimes. What is the problem? Our minds. The mind. Your mind is the problem. All this dust on the mirror. Where are we going? Where are we coming from? And we ponder about things, deep, profound things. And we make distinctions. And we discriminate, sometimes to good purpose. But sitting is something else. Meditation, you know, they have a word for it. It is called mushin or munen. Mushin is no mind, and munen is no thought. No me to think. Mushin. There was a teacher. He was a Korean. A master, Taiyin. And he lived around 1350, somewhere in there. And he wrote a thing called Mirror for Zen Students. And I'm going to read you a little bit of that. It's quite interesting. And he says, what is required of Zen devotees is to see into the phrase that lives and not into the one which is dead. Try to search for the sense of the koan that you have. Putting your whole mental strength into the task, like a mother hen sitting on her eggs, like a cat trying to catch a mouse, like a hungry one eagerly looking everywhere for food, like a thirsty one seeking everywhere for water, like a child that is lost looking for its mother. Which happens now and then, you know. Children get lost, and one time in a department store, and this isn't Master Taiyin, by the way, there was this little kid in the department store wailing and sobbing and shrieking, you know how they do, and he was lost, and he wants his mother, and he's going to set up a hullabaloo until he gets his mother back. So the clerk comes over to comfort him and asks him, you know, what does your mother look like? Like a woman without me. Lost. Because you see, she's lost too. In the kid's head. Yeah. If you exert yourself as seriously and as desperately as that, the time will surely come when the sense of the koan will dawn upon you. There are three factors making for success in the study of Zen. I got a good lesson for summer session on that. There are three factors making for success in the study of Zen. One is great faith. That means you got to move your faith from what you think to something else. Second is great resolution. You're going to do it. And three, a great spirit of inquiry. You ask. You want to know. You want to know. And you want to know. This, somehow I got to know. When any of these are lacking, he says, it is like a cauldron with a broken leg. It limps. At all moments of your life, regardless of what you are doing, exert yourself into seeing the meaning of the koan. Keep the koan always before your mind and never release the spirit of inquiry. As the inquiry goes on steadily and uninterruptedly, you will come to see that there is no intellectual clue in the koan, that it is altogether devoid of sense as you ordinarily understand that word, that it is flat, devoid of taste, has nothing appetizing about it, and that you are beginning to have a certain feeling of uneasiness and impatience. And when you come to this state, it is the moment for you to cast aside the scabbard, that is, draw the sword, throw yourself down the abyss, and by so doing, lay the foundation for Buddhahood. You try throwing yourself down the abyss. Do it. Do not think that the meaning of the koan is at the moment of your holding it up for solution. What is a hand? Oh, now I know it. No. Do not reason about it or exercise your imagination over it. Do not wait for Satori to come over you by clearing your mind of its confused state. Only collect yourself on the unintelligibility of the koan, over which the mind evidently has no control. Now, Tayin cautions his students on the following 10 points. Do not calculate according to your imagination. Let not your attention be drawn to where the master raises his eyebrows or twinkles his eyes. Do not try to extract meaning from the way the koan is worded. Do not try to demonstrate on the words. Do not think that the sense of the koan is to be grasped where it is held out as an object of thought. Do not take Zen for a state of mere passivity. Do not judge the koan with a dualistic standard. Do not take the koan as pointing to absolute emptiness. Do not rationalize on this koan, and do not keep your mind in the attitude of waiting for Satori to turn up. Zen is not simply an exercise in meditation or passivity. Zen has a definite object, which is to open the mind to Satori. The koan is used as a kind of a pole with which to leap over the stream of relativity to the other side, which is the absolute. And the unique feature of Zen is that all this is accomplished without resorting to religious concepts such as sin or salvation or future life or und so weiter und so weiter und so weiter, huh? Etc. And then he says, you will finally find yourself like an old rat getting into the farthest corner of the barn, where it suddenly perceives, by veering clear around the way, it sees the way of escape. See? To measure a koan by intellectual standards, as you ordinarily do other things, to live your life up and down the stream of birth and death, to be always assailed by feelings of fear, worry, and uncertainty. All this is owing to your imagination and your calculating mind. You ought to know how to rise above the trivialities in life in which most people are found drowning themselves. Do not waste time asking how to do it. Just put your whole state into the business. It is like a mosquito biting an iron bull. At the very moment the iron absolutely rejects your frail nose, you for once forget yourself. You penetrate and the work is done. That's tie-in. Very interesting to me. Last week at this wedding, I met this young man who'd been in Zen for 10 years. Back in Rhode Island, under a Korean master. And it's very interesting because to me, because here, you know, we do everything one-on-one. Everybody is working with a different koan. Everybody has different problems with life, so you all get different things. And it's as you answer them, of course, and you get other ones. But here, he has given his group, he gives his group, 10 koan, all at once. And he may ask you a question about any one of them at any time. That's his method. It's Korean Zen. So sometimes, you know, we look around and say, I don't want to go over there because they do it different. Everybody does it different. I mean, you know, we're trained by somebody and we do it as close as we can to that somebody's training. But it's going to be different. Because I'm not Henry. The foundation of Zen. Now, Zen, you know, is mostly a word to people. But Zen is something else. And it has its foundation in mind. But the mind, of course, is this mushin. No mind. It is the gate of no gate. In a manner of speaking, it's not like this. A young fellow told me that his teacher is working on a book, and it's called The 10 Gates, in which he talks about these 10 koan. They're the gates. See? So now we got this gate of no gate. How can you pass through a no gate? Strange thing. All of a sudden you're on the other side. So, boom. No gate, but you're there. And there's a little thing, maybe you've heard it, it's a little poem-like. Things that come in through the gates. Now, this time we're speaking of the senses. You know, like Rinzai said, there is a man of true rank, and he is coming in and out of the gates of your face. Now, who is this true man? Things that come in through the gates are not treasure. What is gained thusly as a result of cause and effect has a beginning and an end. and will be annihilated. This is, Ganto said this to Seppo long, long time ago. In the summer of 1228, whereabouts, Ikai, whom we know as Mumon, he was in East China. He was in the monastery of Ryosho. And he taught by using the koan of the teachers that had gone before him. And it is said he used them like brickbats, you know, battering at the gate. Batter at the gate. And he wrote down all of these koan that he used from his teachers before them, and in time they became a collection. And from beginning to end, there wasn't any system to it. Mumonkan, it is called. Kan is the barrier. The barrier, the gates of Mumon. Mumonkan. The Kan is like a bar that's across the gate. And in this Mumonkan, there's no system to it. It's all higgledy-piggledy, you know. And the term case, or which we call koan, originally had this kung'an, was something that's presented for the public. And it had originally some kind of a connotation that there was a treasure. There was a treasure and there was a sword. And Mumon said, if anyone is a brave chap, he will cut his way through without a thought of any danger. He will be hindered by no one. He will advance steadily. If anyone hesitates, however, he is like a man watching a horse gallop past a window. In the twinkling of an eye, it is gone. And that do that way, doesn't it? Yeah. Have a cup of tea. You know, have a cup of tea. Very social. Have a cup of tea. And this is very symbolic for Zen, though. It's symbolic for Japan, where they have places where you can just go and have tea. You do the tea ceremony. And these are very clean, neat little places. Tea there is not an ordinary drink. It's green, frothy. In India, it's quite a different story. People like Gandhi, you know, he wouldn't allow anyone in his ashram to drink tea. He said it was a sin if you drink tea. You can't drink tea here. And of course, there is the story of Bodhidharma and the tea. And he's sitting in front of this wall for all these years. And, you know, the first couple of years, first couple of months, first couple of weeks, he must have gotten tired. Hmm? And to keep himself from falling asleep, he plucked off his eyelids and he dropped them into the ground. And lo, the tea plant grew. So tea represents an awareness. Tea represents an alertness. And in Japan, of course, we have this ritual of tea, the chan no yu, which carries this spiritual aspect. You know, you go into this tea room, and it takes years to learn how to do this. You go into the tea room, and there is this silence. And then gradually in this silence, there comes the sound of the water boiling. And so one's ears are cleansed. And then the aroma of the tea and the sense of smell, the nose, is cleansed. And by the tasting, the mouth is cleansed. And the way the cup is handled, you know, the sense of touch is cleansed. All of this to cleanse the mind of what the senses have brought in. So that when you drink the tea, you know, the mind should be very clear. You've wiped it. It is the purity, you know, the ritual of purity. See, it is a spiritual discipline. And they say when tea is made with water that is drawn from the well of the mind, whose bottom is beyond measure, we really have what is called chanoyu. Tea is not just entertainment. Have a cup of tea. Do I know you? No. Have a cup of tea. Do I know you? Yes. Have a cup of tea. And the Fusan, the manager of the place, is very puzzled by this. So Joshu calls him very loudly, "Manager, are you here?" You know, and the manager says, "Yes, sir, of course I'm here." And Joshu says then, "Have a cup of tea." Now this calling loudly, you know, this sudden shout, you know, it's a sound. And the Fusan in that instant became aware. And he responded from this awareness, "Of course I'm here. Can't be any place else, can he? I'm here. Where is your awareness? Where is your awareness? The old past and the old future. Simply consciousness remains. Consciousness responds. And Joshu says, "Have a cup of tea. Have a cup of tea." Because the great way is gateless, and there are 1,000 alleys. If you once pass the barrier, in royal solitude you walk the universe. And that's Muman, old Ikai. Yeah, have a cup of tea. Okay. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.